I believe we now have the opportunity, more than that, we have the responsibility to bring our country together. Together in the face of this financial crisis. Together in the determination that we will find a way through. Together in the hope, in the belief, in the knowledge that better times will lie ahead. Thank you.
David Cameron, who's just been given a standing ovation after a serious speech focusing on the economy, delivered, we were told, to match the serious times we now live in. I'm Nick Watt and welcome to Politics Weekly. This week's edition comes to you from the Birmingham International Convention Centre, where the Conservatives have been holding their party conference. In this programme, we'll be asking whether Cameron has captured the mood and whether the Tories can measure up during the global financial crisis. Joining me to discuss these matters is Gabby Hinsliff, the political editor of The Observer. Hello, Gabby.
Hello.
We have Jenny Russell, the Guardian columnist. Hello, Jenny.
Hello.
And finally, we have Martin Kettle, also a Guardian columnist. Hello, Martin.
Hi, Nick.
Welcome to you all.
We don't need more of the same. We need change. Experience is the excuse of the incumbent down the ages. Experience is what they always say when they want to stop change. In 1979, James Callaghan had been Home Secretary, Foreign Secretary, Chancellor, and then Prime Minister. But thank God we swapped him for Margaret Thatcher. Just think about it. If we really listened to this argument about experience, we would never change a government, ever. We would have, wait for it, we'd have Gordon Brown as Prime Minister forever. I'm not going to go on. There are people in balconies up there.
That was David Cameron making a joke in answer to Gordon Brown's most serious charge against him, that he is a novice who is unfit to become Prime Minister. Well, I caught up with the Shadow Business Secretary, Alan Duncan, after the speech. I started by asking Alan a tough question. Had his boss pulled it off?
I think he did. And actually, he confounded all his critics. I mean, this whole week has been one in which political judgment has been so important, because if you get the tone wrong or drop a catch and or appear to just get the wrong attitude in the middle of all this financial turmoil, it could really, you know, come back and hit you in the face. But on three occasions this week, David's got it right. You know, the opening tone on Sunday, his sort of turmoil special speech, if you want to call it that, yesterday, and now today. Today, he hardly bashed Labour. No one can say this was knocking copy. It was visionary, but it absolutely destroyed the charges that had been made against him of being inexperienced. It painted a picture of Britain and a realistic picture of Britain's finances along with the means of addressing them. So I think this really looked like a sober, sensible, constructive speech, which I think will have earned a lot of respect.
So, Gabby, that was a very different speech to David Cameron's no-notes effort last year. What did you think?
I have to be honest, I was a little bit disappointed. I think it wasn't the strongest speech I've ever heard him make. And I did think so that he hadn't quite bolted together all the necessary bits. I mean, you would have to be slightly superhuman to bolt together all the necessary bits of this week, which is to respond to the allegation that you're a novice and to respond to the financial crisis when you don't know what could have happened 5 minutes before you stand up, and somehow to yoke in what was the existing Tory programme before that. But it kind of felt as if the speech was a bit too bolted together. We did a bit on the financial crisis and anyway on to what I would have said before, which is, you know, rah-rah for our boys in Afghanistan and Iraq, and here's some corporation tax cuts, and we're going to fix broken Britain. He didn't explain how the two things fit together or how things have changed because of the financial crisis. There was a line where he said in the speech, you know, that we have to help the nation make sense of this crisis and explain how we're going to get out of it. And I just didn't really did that in the end.
So, Martin, not just a broken Britain, a broken speech as well.
I think it was a problem speech, but I think he made the problem for himself by making too many speeches this week. I think the big thing that Cameron had to do this week was to attack Gordon Brown's claims to be the only person who can deal with the financial crisis. And I think the impact of his effort to do so was somewhat diffused by the fact that he did it in various different ways. And I thought that the earlier session on Tuesday, when he did all the bipartisan stuff, I thought that was misconceived. I think he should have done done some of that in the speech today, which of course he did indeed. But really, he wanted, I think he needed to end the week absolutely challenging Brown's claims. It was quite a right-wing speech in many ways, and I think later on we'll come on and talk about some of those things.
Absolutely. Jenny Russell, are you going to rally to the defence of David Cameron?
I think it was a more impressive speech than perhaps Martin and Gabby felt. I found the start with the stuff about the armed forces rather awkward, but then that's probably because we're not in sympathy with that kind of Tory view on the armed forces. That seemed a little strange. On the other hand, he was at least talking about Britain being a nation at war, and it's very notable that last week at the Labour Party conference, the word war was scarcely mentioned by anybody, least of all the Prime Minister. But I think where he worked was that the speech did have an argument, I thought. He went to explaining, first of all, that what he was principally going to lay out was not particularly policy detail, but the issue of character. And of course he's right in that in contemporary politics, what we very often vote for is what we think of the character of the person who's going to lead us. And as the events of the last fortnight have shown, you don't necessarily know what kind of crises are going to hit. And therefore what you need to know is what kind of person is going to deal with this and what are the principles they're going to work from and what kind of depth of character they've got. And I thought he was very effective at doing that. It also allowed him a let out in case one started to question about where the detail was, because he was essentially saying this is about laying out my personality rather than anything else. I thought he was very clever in the way that he attacked Brown without doing so head on, that it was effective to talk about how experience is always the defence of the incumbent, and yet when things have gone badly wrong, what you need is change, and you need a new and fresh approach. And his paragraph towards the end, where he implicitly criticised Brown in every single sentence without actually naming him, I thought really delivered a punch home. And the final thing, which I thought was rather devastating about it, was that this is the kind of speech which currently none of the contenders to Gordon Brown could make. There's nobody who has that ease on a platform, who can ad-lib from a speech as he was doing, and who talks in natural patterns and rhythms of everyday speech. There were almost no clunking phrases in there of the kind that we've become so accustomed to from politicians.
Well, a fan of David Cameron there, and Jenny Russell.
Fan of David Cameron's. Good presentation.
Need to qualify that. Thank you for that. Well, we asked Larry Elliott, the Guardian's economics editor, to tell us about one of the big themes of the week. And this is David Cameron's offer of bipartisan support to help the government through the current financial crisis.
I think it illustrates starkly the depth of this crisis and the fear that's stalking the city and Westminster, that this crisis is not going away. In fact, it seems to be getting worse week by week and day by day. And the politicians here are trying to do what the politicians can't do on the other side of the pond and show a united front in the face of adversity, and probably much needed, I would have said.
And Larry, do you think that this is genuine? Do you think it's genuine from the Conservatives? And do you think that the government is genuinely interested in responding in kind?
Well, there's a bit of politics involved here. Obviously, the Conservatives want to look as though they're being statesmanlike. And I think the government feels the need to be a little bit magnanimous and doesn't want to be too dismissive. I'm sure that in reality, Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling would really rather like to be left to get on with this on their own. But the state of the world is almost like sort of the financial equivalent of 1940. So we've got the sort of national government type political mentality to go with it. And I think that just illustrates where we are.
Now, you've been up in Birmingham, the Conservative Party conference. Can I just ask you, how have the Conservatives been handling this? And most importantly, when you have a candidate for Prime Minister who's 41, a candidate for Chancellor who's 37, how serious do they look in an economic crisis up against the tried and tested Alistair Darling and Gordon Brown?
Well, they've been doing their best to address that structural problem. I think they do have a problem of lack of experience, and they perceive that themselves. They have been quite seriously devoted over the last few days to showing that they are big enough to tackle this crisis. I thought George Osborne's speech on Monday was a relatively solid piece of work, actually. I thought that he gave the government a good hiding over its record over the economy, much of which was deserved, and he did try to lay out what he would be doing as Chancellor of the Exchequer. I think they still have this problem of being seen as a bit wet behind the ears, but they know that's a problem and are trying to address it.
Well, I'm joined now by Steve Bell, the Guardian cartoonist, who's hard at work drawing another cartoon for the paper. Steve, can you tell us, you've identified a theme at this week's Tory conference?
Well, the theme with Osborne and Cameron, and I think it's a problem they both share, is their extreme youthfulness. And it's a real problem for them. So I've been doing them as Teletubbies.
And tell us, how did the Teletubbies idea come to you?
And what was I doing at the time? I know what it was. It was the backdrop. It's this bizarre backdrop of clouds. I know they've had it for a few years, and it's quite impressive. It's all puffy clouds and trees and grass. One morning this week in the hotel, I just happened to turn on the Teletubbies, and I saw it. And suddenly it clicked. There was this sort of hallucinatory, weird backdrop, which is blue clouds, and it has that same air of unreality. And there is an air of unreality about Tory world this week. So it seems to be like Tubby Land.
Well, Gabby Hinsliff, political editor of The Observer, as the youngest person on the panel, I'm going to ask you to deal with this key issue. David Cameron and George Osborne are too young. They are Teletubbies.
It's not just really Cameron and Osborne. I mean, the one thing that's so noticeable about this conference is everywhere you go on the fringe, you know, people who look about 12 who turn out to be the PPC for somewhere or other and you know, busy debating what job they're going to do in cabinet when they get there. Whether youth is necessarily always a disadvantage, I mean, David Miliband has the same problem of looking like he's just sort of, you know, just turned up to do work experience, and it does somewhat undermine one's gravitas. But I think it's less of a problem for Cameron. Osborne is getting better at it. He sounds better. Someone's taught him to lower and deepen his voice and slow down, and he's starting to sound slightly more authoritative than he used to. I think it's not such a sort of crippling disadvantage as it maybe was a year ago. I think both of them have grown into their roles.
Jenny, that's interesting. Gabby's saying that George Osborne and David Cameron have grown into their roles, and that George Osborne gave that speech earlier this week on Monday and was very, very serious. That's what both Osborne and Cameron have tried to do this week, strike a serious note. How do you think they've done with that?
Yeah, I think they've been very effective at that. When Osborne was first announced as Shadow Chancellor and I watched his first few speeches, I had an absolutely allergic reaction to this pompous, claret and steak little public schoolboy who just looked as if he...
Jenny's getting in there. She's not a spokeswoman for the Tories.
But he did truly look as if he'd just emerged from university straight into a job in the city and wouldn't know what the world was like outside that kind of gilded cage. And I thought that his speech on Monday, as Gabby thought, was a striking difference. He hit exactly the right note, whereas Philip Hammond, who's a great deal older than Osborne and has the long grey hair to show for it, had, I thought, sounded almost smug about the financial crisis. Osborne came on and sounded like a man who felt that he was dealing with something that was really went beyond party politics. And I thought he was very convincing. And I was just noticing Cameron just now, he's partly gained the assurance that simply comes from both wielding power within an organisation and knowing that you may well be the next person to run the country. But he is also, very usefully for him, developing a few lines. And he doesn't have such a baby-faced appearance.
So, Martin, praise there from Gabby and Jenny for the way that George Osborne and David Cameron have responded this week. But you obviously have doubts about this bipartisanship. You don't think it's genuine. I think you wrote earlier this week that David Cameron performed a humiliating U-turn when he announced he was going to support the government.
You know, just let me say my tuppence worth on the age thing. I don't think the age thing matters at all. I think that in the end what matters and is seen to matter is what people think they're going to do. I think, and I agree that Osborne made a rather effective speech this week. I think they overreacted to the crisis this week. I think they came to Birmingham with a very clear picture, certainly what they were saying behind the scenes, and it was certainly borne out in the initial sessions, of really trying to nail Gordon Brown. And I think that was the logical thing for the Tories to do, and to nail some of his pretensions in the current crisis, which have obviously been very beneficial to him in the polls immediately. I think that was the right thing to do. And I think they then slightly took their eye off the ball. They got distracted by everything that was going on in America, the situation with Bradford and Bingley, and they felt the need to make a bigger intervention, a bigger bipartisan intervention than I think that they really needed to do. I think it was a slight kind of loss of confidence. But I thought in the end Cameron got back on track, more or less. But I think this has not been a good week for Cameron, not been a very good week for the Tories. And I think that it will take some time before they they rally around a consistent line and really get it across in the country. I think they've been knocked a bit sideways by all the turbulence financially and politically of the last month. And I don't think that's an age thing. I think that's just kind of modern politics, an overreaction to the 24-hour news cycle.
Gabby, do you think that's fair of Martin to say that George Osborne and David Cameron overreacted? I mean, overreacting is what John McCain did, suspending his campaign, then yes. not suspending it. They couldn't do nothing, could they?
I have to say, I have to respectfully disagree with Martin there. I think they did the right thing. I think there was a genuine sense of panic and foreboding on Tuesday, and that they are essentially treating it as a wartime situation. As you know, if we just invaded the Falklands, then you have politicians from both sides come together and say, you know, at a time of national emergency, we don't distract from the government's difficult task by opposing. And I sort of felt that they had captured the gravity of what had happened, and also that, I mean, I think what inspired it was the feeling that was looking at what happened in America, where you had this sort of shambolic spectacle of Republicans voting against the bailout plan, whether or not you think it was a good plan, for reasons that just sounded stupid and petty. And I didn't think they wanted to be in Parliament next week opposing the bill that's coming up on bank lending on sort of slightly spurious technical grounds. I think they actually struck the right note. I mean, how long this sort of spirit of bipartisanship will last before they go back to slagging off the government for getting it wrong, I wouldn't like to say, but I think it was probably the right call. And it was the only way that David Cameron could actually have got on the news that day, which I'm sure was also a factor in their calculations.
No, I absolutely agree. And I think that they were in difficulty because at that time people were panicking, and it would have looked very peculiar to have the opposition coming in and slamming into the Prime Minister to a point when actually everybody can see that there are a lot of problems caused by Brown over the past decade. I don't think that needs to be rubbed in. And as Gabby says, at this point, the difference between us and America is that, of course, nobody actually needs the Conservatives. They could stand up and jump up and down about any recovery plan that Gordon Brown put forward, but because we effectively have an elective parliamentary dictatorship, Brown will be able to push through any plan he wants, no matter what the Conservatives' opinion is. If they want to be on the news, if they want to look statesmanlike, if they want to look part of the rescue, they have got to stand behind it.
Martin, can I just ask you what we think is happening in the wider picture in British politics? I mean, in the last 2 weeks, Gordon Brown seems to be staging something of a recovery. And there is an argument out there that actually what's happening now is quite difficult for centre-right parties. Centre-right parties believe in a light touch on regulation. And now you have a president of the United States. Indeed, you have the most right-wing president of the United States moving to the left of Leonid Brezhnev and nationalising everything in sight. Does that make it difficult for centre-right parties like the Tories?
Well, I think it's difficult for all the parties for different reasons. I think that the difficulty for the Tories in this situation is that they are wedded to the free market approach, which is at the root of what has happened here. They own it just as Labour owns it. I think there's almost some sort of instinctual thing going on, I think, at the moment amongst the Tories, that they almost as if they sense that Labour has sort of lurched a bit to the left, and that gives them a bit of political space to both play the bipartisan centrist line and at the same time to say things which probably, 6 months ago they wouldn't have dared to say. I think the political space that's opened up may not survive. It's so difficult to anticipate what's going to happen on the markets and in the financial institutions over the next few days, few weeks, few months even, that I don't think we are in a settled situation yet. But I do think that if we get into a situation where basically you've got what could be caricatured as an old Labour party fighting an old Tory Conservative Party, then I think there's only going to be one winner, and that's the old Tory Party.
Right. And Gabby, how do you see the broader political picture? Do you see Gordon Brown coming back into play? Is he alive again?
I think there's one answer now and one answer in 6 months' time. And I think now, when you have an imminent crisis, people tend to gravitate towards the existing Prime Minister, and there tends to be a sort of tide of support for him. Also, he can be seen to be doing things. Not that what Britain does makes a huge amount of difference. It's what the Americans do that makes a difference. But at least, as a government, you act. Whereas as an opposition, you just stand around saying things about it and you don't tend to look particularly statesmanlike. But in 6 months' time, when the effects of what is happening now start to feed through into the real economy, people start losing their jobs, I suspect. do you love a government for that? You know, it's rare for people to be grateful to the government that they feel cost them their job or their home or their savings or whatever else.
Jenny?
I think the real danger for Brown at the moment is that lots of people who advise the Treasury and are in the city and so on feel that actually he hasn't grasped the true nature of this crisis either, and that he's been remarkably slow to act. And of all people, that high priest of the free market, Owen Stelzer, was on the radio yesterday saying that he just simply couldn't understand why Brown hadn't acted immediately to bring in a Paulson-style plan, because, as he said, there are no political barriers to his doing so here. He can decree anything that he likes. And I think in 6 months' time, people might be turning around and asking, why the hell didn't this government, this man who was really supposed to understand the economy, get on with what was needed to do to bail the country out much, much faster?
State intervention from Owen Stelzer. It is a new world. Thank you for that. Well, we asked Simon Hoggett, The Guardian's parliamentary sketchwriter, to give us his impressions of the conference week.
It's been an interesting conference because, of course, the Tories for the first time believe in 10 years, or indeed in 14 years, that they have a very good chance of winning the next election. But they've been told to be very non-triumphalist. They mustn't say, when we are the government. They've always got to produce some line like, if the electorate give us the privilege of serving them at the next election, or if we are fortunate enough to form the government after that, etc., which is has given a slightly downbeat tone. What they, I think, some of the delegates would like to have heard was a bit of roaring, you know, we are going to kick these incompetent buffoons out. And there's been less of that, and surprisingly, David Cameron, who gave a very bipartisan speech on Tuesday, saying, you know, I stand with the government in tackling this terrible crisis we all face, didn't, as I expected, wrongly, really tear into Gordon Brown greatly, at any great length. So, given the fact that they're way ahead in the polls, there has been a slightly downbeat, and of course everybody is worried about the economic situation. Been some pretty good speeches. George Osborne really got them going, and of course he hit them with this bizarre notion of giving government money to certain councils to stop them raising council tax for 2 years.
I can tell you today that the next Conservative government will freeze your council tax for at least 2 years.
Seems very odd. A, it seems to be taking away authority from local councils, and B, it's yet more government spending. But of course, it sounded great because people don't like spending council tax. They resent it because it comes in one great bill every week. I think George Osborne is becoming slightly addicted to that kind of applause. He got it last year when he said he was going to raise the threshold for inheritance tax. And I think, as Harry Hill says about heroin, applause is very Moorish.
Progressive ends, conservative means. This is a big argument about our future. And that is a big change. And it's because we had the courage to change that we're actually able to make it. We changed because we knew that we had to make ourselves relevant in the 21st century.
That was David Cameron saying the Conservatives are now Britain's progressive party. Martin Kettle, The Guardian, recently ran a series on the Conservatives in which it subjected them to the progressive test. What do you think?
I don't think that the Conservative Party is really heart and soul and head a progressive party at all at the moment. And I think there were a lot of really interesting things in what Cameron said in the rest of his speech, which rather indicated the limits of his progressivism. I thought there was a kind of veiled reference, for instance, to being prepared to take on the unions over public spending. You know, if borrowing really balloons out of control, a Tory government could find itself really making cuts in the public services and being prepared to fight that corner. So, you know, that I think would not be seen classically as a progressive thing to do. Likewise, I think the assault, very powerfully expressed assault that he made on NHS bureaucracy, on the MRSA instance, which he cited in his speech, and some of the things he said about education, I think they will, you know, they will not sit easily with the average voter who does think of themselves as a progressive voter, wondering whether to vote for David Cameron's Tories. That's why I said earlier that I think there has been more political space opened up for the Tories, and I think it's a particularly volatile time, and it's quite difficult to say how it's all going to end. I think we have, you know, the dust hasn't settled yet. We can't see the scope of what the political casualties are in this battlefield.
Gabby, this talk of the Conservatives as progressives, is this a cynical makeover, or is something deeper going on here?
It's funny, isn't it? The opening to conference was, in fact, terribly progressive. We had four, you know, prospective parliamentary candidates standing up, of whom, you know, so we have a black Scottish trade unionist and a female candidate and all the rest of it. And that's classic sort of, and that's who used to work in Liverpool dockyards. So it's classic Cameroon, we're not the old Tories kind of setup. And then all of a sudden you have this kind of video of the armed forces and a speech which is about the army, tax cuts and marriage, which is not terribly. And there was a chunk about crime where he talked about, you know, he said, you know, many people may think that the answer in this hall will think that the answer to crime is longer prison sentences and being tougher. But actually, we've got to look at the causes of crime, which was classic Tony Blair circa 1994. So there's still bits of it there. What was missing, I thought, from this speech, interesting as well, was almost anything on the environment. The only green thing was Samantha Cameron's dress when she came on at the end. And you do feel that they clearly feel they have established a space for themselves by talking progressively in the past. They've established a space where they can move on to more classic right-wing ground, and they feel they've earned the right to do that. And that's what you felt was happening in this speech.
Jenny, let me ask you, when The Guardian ran that series a few weeks ago asking the question, are the Conservatives progressives? We got into terrible trouble with the Labour Party. Leaked memos to other papers saying how outrageous this was. And I think the one thing that drives people on the left mad about describing David Cameron as progressive is that in 2003 he voted for Section 28. Recently he voted to cut the upper limit, time limit on abortion, and he also voted to restrict IVF treatment to lesbian couples. Do you think that people who are taking him seriously as being a progressive are sort of suckers?
Well, I think it's a very muddled picture. I don't think you can say that someone isn't progressive just because they don't agree with every goal that the left might describe as progressive. For instance, I think his schools policy is in some ways very progressive because he's going to give a huge pupil premium to children from disadvantaged areas. And the Tories' policy is to say that it's actually almost immoral to force children who currently live in poor areas to go to the lousy schools, which are all that serve them now. And they're saying it would be much better if people could set up their own schools with their own agendas. So you could argue that that's very progressive because it's about giving real opportunity. But I think there's absolutely no question that the Tories don't know whether they're progressive or not, and individual Tories have very different answers. One of the things I've been very struck by this week, going to some of the sessions, for instance, on welfare reform, is that you hear all this rather moving stuff about how the voluntary sector is fantastic, about the enormous and valuable work that's being done in community transformation projects and so on. And then what's the actual content of the speech on welfare? It's all about punitive methods to get the currently unemployed back to work. Now, some of that may be necessary, but where's the funding for all the voluntary work, which the Conservatives have said in the past is going to transform their vision of the state? There's no mention of any funding at all. There's just this weasel word support. So I think again and again, you're left with a sense that some parts of the Tory party are genuinely changed. I was at a very interesting fringe which was talking about the rehabilitation of offenders and the absolute necessity of giving them paths back to housing and work in their communities and families from the moment they enter jail, completely unlike previous Tory policy. And then you get other parts which are just traditional, like the enormous applause through there for the idea of the United Kingdom or low taxes.
Martin?
Well, I just think that all that's true. I agree with that. And I went to some interesting fringe meetings, which I thought on questions of childcare, family policy, were you know, the sort of things that you could easily have heard in Liberal Democrat or Labour conferences too. But I think the thing I just want to say here is that this conference is completely different from any Tory conference that you could have gone to 10 or 20 years ago. I mean, the culture of the conference is just utterly changed. Now, whether it's progressive or not is another matter, but as an experience, it's an altogether less traditional Conservative party. It may be drawing on Conservative values, Conservative traditions in lots of other ways, but I mean, it just socially, culturally, I mean, it's in another world from anything from the Thatcher or even the major period of the Tory party.
I would agree. I've been going to Tory party conferences for 18 years, and there used to be places where you just heard the most outrageous, racist, sexist, Little Englander, hostile, angry comments about almost everything. You used to feel, as someone from the left, that you were entering hostile territory the entire time you were there. And you would never hear, basically, a liberal perspective or any sense that people who were not leading prosperous lives had done so through anything other than deep moral faults of their own. So this is a transformed body. How far they would actually put any progressive principles in practice once they got into office is a very difficult one, I think, because the other thing that becomes clear when you talk to people is that although they believe in lots of transformation, they still also believe fundamentally in low taxes and a small state. And I don't know how far you can go with progressive goals if that's where you're starting from.
They are serious, I think, about talking about the third sector in a way which I thought at the Labour conference, quite strikingly, there was an absence of discussion about the third sector there. It really was, in a sense, as Cameron had classed it, you know, that it's either the state or it's the individual. And I think on that, he maybe unknowingly did rather hit the nail on the head. I mean, at least I think the Tories and the Lib Dems really do talk about institutions that are the intermediate institutions between the state and
that
the family.
Very cheeky, actually, throwing the "there's no such thing as society" line back at Labour. That was
because, of
fairly
course,
audacious.
We all
I thought.
Know who said that.
Indeed, or who constantly denies she ever said that.
Indeed.
But yes.
And Gabby, let me just ask you, a Transform Party, the Right On Party, I mean, if these guys had been at university in the late 80s and early 90s, would they have been wearing Doc Martens and denim jeans and all that sort of stuff, which of course they weren't because they were in the Bullingdon, the Right On Party?
The culture has definitely changed, and it isn't just skin deep. It isn't just that they make them recycle their flyers and not wear those pound sign badges on their lapels anymore. It's different people here than it was 10 years ago. That's true. What it feels actually, although this year, what it feels is not so much transformed as sanitised. There is a feeling that somehow by purging sort of the unwanted element of the party out, and also by making the shadow cabinet be so on their best behaviour that none of them dares say anything or go to any parties or hang out in the bar after 9:30, that what you have done is almost knock the life out of conference. I imagine as a delegate it hasn't been very much fun.
Although it's really striking that there's just no champagne here at all. I mean, last week...
There is. You're looking in the wrong places.
Really?
There is.
Oh, well, last week, almost every Labour reception seemed to have champagne flowing at it. But I've obviously been to the wrong parties.
Well, I think Gabby's point is a really interesting one about the change in the fringe. I mean, the fringe meetings are entirely kind of consonant with the main conference, whereas, you know, the characteristic of the Tory Party conference in the 1980s and the 1990s was that on the fringe you had really significant political stories, you know, as ministers, ex-ministers, think tanks, whatever, really did mobilise on the fringe in an oppositional way. There's none of that now.
It's not just the lack of the dissent, it's the lack of ideas. I mean, I felt Labour Party's fringes last week were kind of slightly dead. It was the feeling of a stale, flat party that's run out of ideas and run out of new thinking. And I expected to see a lot more new thinking here. I expected to see new ideas bubbling up on the fringe. And actually, they weren't. The fringe was really just an extension of the conference floor, where they all discussed at slightly greater length things that were going on in the conference floor. I was surprised by that.
Although there was one fringe that did produce an exclusive story, which was the Observer fringe on Tuesday night.
Obviously, I should have said apart from the Guardian and Observer. Brilliant festivals of new thinking.
And under the brilliant questioning of the Observer's chief political commentator, Andrew Rawnsley, Eric Pickles, who is the shadow local government secretary, made what was seen as a rather inappropriate joke about John Prescott's bulimia, and he then had to apologise.
Mm-hmm. Can you fat men apologising.
Indeed. Can you tell us about that? And also, does that show that behind the nice, cuddly, friendly Tory party, there lurks an unpleasant side? Tell us
certainly
about it.
Behind the nice, cuddly, friendly Eric Pickles, who, because he looks like a sort of northern nightclub comic, everyone assumes is a sort of lovely, genial, old soul Father Christmas, and actually has a certain malicious side to him, I think. What he essentially said was he was talking about whether his sort of views of his Labour colleagues, and he said, when I heard that John Prescott was bulimic, I wondered, did I cause some of that? And he said, thought about it, and I thought, good. And that obviously got a laugh in the room, and in the context of everything else he was saying, didn't sound perhaps so extraordinary as it did outside it. What was actually more, well, as surprising, was he was asked about... Eric Pickles is not the slimmest person in the world, and when he was asked about Andrew Lansley's argument that fat people have only themselves to blame and should be held responsible for their weight, he did point out that Andrew Lansley looks like he enjoys a good mixed grill himself. And while, again, it was a joke, there was a definite edge under there. I don't think Eric Pickles thinks that is wise politically, to offend a third of the population who are overweight.
I think on this question of, you know, what's the real Tories underneath the underneath the skin, as it were, you still get in this conference, I think, whenever there's anything which has any European connection of any kind or resonance, you definitely get that hostility. And I mean, I think that's why the Human Rights Act is so kind of so provocative to them because of its...
And Cherie Blair was heckled when she talked about it.
Cherie Blair had a hard time at a fringe meeting organised by The Sun. And, Cameron had a line in his speech about the human rights culture. You know, well, I mean, a progressive party that viscerally dislikes talk of human rights is a bit of a contradiction in terms, it seems to me. And, you know, this is a party which, you know, is still very preoccupied with its anti-European agenda.
Jenny?
I think what they're saying about the Human Rights Act in context perhaps was a little more subtle than that. I think this is one of the most successful parts of the speech, in which Cameron attacked the fact that under a Labour government there were so many restrictions from health and safety and bureaucracy and indeed the Human Rights Act that, for instance, school teachers are prevented from putting plasters on children's grazed knees in case this contravenes their rights or in case they're thought to be guilty of child abuse. And as a mother who has for years had children coming home with grazed knees, which have gone septic during the day for exactly this reason, I think that he will have struck a chord with the country. I think there is a sense that people have constantly that they are not trusted as adults and they're not trusted as individuals, and that in fact social bonds are being horribly eroded because people are no longer free to respond to one another on the assumption that we are decent people who can behave like adults, make our own choices, run our own risks, and that there's too much supervision in our daily lives. And I think that is something which people really feel around the country.
I have to say the message didn't quite get through to conference. While we were listening to the speech, one of my colleagues from the Daily Mail, no less, was Scourger for Health and Safety, was moved on by a steward because he was sitting underneath a camera and he was concerned that if he stood up, he might bang his head. He said he had to move for health and safety reasons. I did think, yes, the message hasn't quite got through.
Well, I think that's about all we've got time for. Thanks to all my guests, the political editor of The Observer, Gabby Hinsliff, and the Guardian columnists, Martin Kettle and Jenny Russell. Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. I'm Nick Watt. Join us again next week when we'll be talking about the first week of the new term at school. Sorry, the new term in Parliament. Till then, goodbye.